Thank you. I want to begin with, we're going to have a conversation about the book, and there will be a reading from the original Spanish as well as from the German translation over the course of this discussion. But since I take for granted that many of you are unfamiliar with the book, and we'd like to initiate you a little bit more closely, and of course there are questions that myself, and I assume that other members of the jury, as well as you're reading the book, this is our opportunity to actually begin to discuss it in closer detail with the author as well as with the translator. And so, Fernanda, I wanted to begin by asking you just a very simple question, or maybe it's not so simple, about the origins of the book and its genesis. I believe that it was published in Spanish in 2017. It appeared this spring in 2019, but if I'm not mistaken, it harks back to 2011, 2012, or what was the impetus for beginning to write it?
Well, thank you, Daniel. Hello, everyone. Just want to briefly say thank you to all of you for being here. And thank you, of course, for the House of the Cultures of the World for this prize. I feel tremendously honored. And actually, I never thought I had a chance with such amazing competitions that I had. I was competing with great books, and I'm so happy to be here. Never thought I would be someday in Berlin and talking to an audience in the language of my great-great-grandfather. So, not in German, I'm sorry, but I'll do what I can in English. Thank you also to Bern, of course, and Matthias and Veronica and all the jurors. Thank you. And I want to say thank you to Linus Guggenberger, my editor at Bag & Bag, for believing in this book in the first place. And really convincing the editors to publish it. And I wrote this novel because I wanted to understand the darker side of my own soul. And of course I didn't, I didn't understand it. Meanwhile I connected with a lot of people, and this prize, I hope it's another way of connecting with the people who will want to read the book, who will be interested in read the book. And thank you for that. And I forgot the question you asked me. No. So what was the genesis of the book? So once I was in Veracruz, who is a small tropical city in the Gulf Coast of Mexico, and I was reading the local paper, and we call it the red note section. It is like the crime section, like true crime stories, and describing a really greasy, really sordid way. And the principal news was that in a small village near Veracruz, they found the body of the witch of the village. And the journalist already knew who was the killer. And it was a woman, she explained that it was because the killer was afraid that the witch was doing witchcraft on him, because there used to be lovers and she wanted back. And I read this and I said, this is very, very Veracruzanian, Mexican journalism. This is so weird. And I will find very strange that the journalist had so much confidence in believing in witchcraft, as in witchcraft could be a motive for killing somebody. And I thought that could be a great story. And at the beginning, I wanted to do a real life story, but it was so dangerous to travel to that small village for reasons that we'll discuss. And I told to myself, maybe to console myself, I said that I could write a fiction story as another way of telling the truth. Not only through journalism, but also through the fiction, we can say the truth.
And this is one feature of the Internationale Literaturpreis, and in particular in the presentations, is the opportunity to share materials So maybe we can test the screen to see. You mentioned to me that there was a particular image that of two policemen in that you wanted to use for La Matosa.
Yeah. For example, this is, I call it the casting, because all of these were people who committed crimes and show up in this journal I was speaking of, this newspaper. And I wanted to see, I wanted to surround myself with real faces and the real looks and almost the consequences and the story that these people tell. These are really young people who got caught committing crimes. And I got to choose a little bit. And this image, who's from a photographer, a Mexican photographer from Veracruz, and it depicts these are two policemen who are walking through this terrain, this lot, and they are in search of a few kilometers ahead. There they found mass graves. Now the thing in Mexico, in Veracruz, is the mass graves. We have like an explosion of violence, you know, like people attacking themselves with machine guns in the street with grenades, like, you know, war, real war. And now there are no more attacks in the street, but we have begun to finding mass graves of all the people who disappear. From the last years. And this photo was published in the newspaper, and I saw this and I said, I can't imagine that story being having place in an ambience like this. And as I was living in Puebla, I didn't get the chance to go to Veracruz, but I Googled map a lot because I wanted to see like the landscape. I grew up near these places, but I wanted to have them present, so I Google map a lot. And these are like the roads of La Matosa, the imaginary town that I created. And it's basically an ensemble of small towns that I know near Veracruz. Then I begin to write.
Yeah. But you also come from a background in journalism, correct? And this is what you did before writing this novel, although I think you had dabbled in, written before.
Kind of, I never was a journalist. I work as an editor in a newspaper. That was my first job. But I did what in Spanish, in Mexico, we call crónica. It's like a literary reportage, like literary writing, but it's journalistic, and I basically studied journalism because I didn't want to. In Mexico, normally, when you want to be a writer, you study literature, but it's weird because it's more academic, and I wanted to be, you know, like in action in the streets. Because when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a FBI agent, like Dan Scully from the X-Files. Or Clarice Starling from the Silence of the Lambs, you know. But I'm Mexican, so I can be an FBI agent, and I discovered that too late. So I became a journalist because I thought it was the closest thing to being a detective in Mexico, yeah.
And then what was it that, about fiction in particular, that appealed to you for telling this story? Because, of course, you can base your material on actual happenings, but the path is a very distinct one and a different one.
At first I saw this new story and I said, I'm going to that town, I'm going to talk to everybody, I'm going to Yale and interview the criminals, and I'm going to see like the place where the body was found, and I wanted to write in cold blood, but you know, a small town, Mexican town, and I wanted to do that. And the story of a woman being killed, and I wanted to show how in Mexico a woman can get killed for nothing and still nothing happens. I wanted to show that, but it was really dangerous, as I was telling you, because these small towns around Veracruz were like the refugees for the criminal groups. They will await there and attack in the principal city when it was necessary. And there were a lots of, ICE and spies, and we call them hawks in Mexico. people who are just as the leaders and the chiefs of the criminal crime, the organized crime are there. They watch who's entering in the town, who's asking questions, who's there. So it wasn't like a good idea to go there. And besides, I'm not an accredited journalist. So I couldn't show like, oh yes, I'm from that newspaper. So I didn't get the chance to do that. And so to console myself, I thought I could invent all that. I could search inside myself for the, you know, the darker truth we have all inside. Every one of us has felt desires of violence, of wanting to kill somebody, but we have stopped because of our education, our culture, our values. And I wanted to see what happens when we cross that line, that line that society draws, and I wanted to figure it out. And for me, fiction is a way to explore all of that. And it's borrowing your own desires, dark desires, but it's also borrowing for what you've read and what you've lived and the movies you watch and all the things that surround you. And well, that's it. I think sometimes fiction, it works in a... how do you say, in a deeper way than journalism.
I think we'll get to the shape and the language of this novel momentarily, because this is actually what makes the reading of it such an exhilarating experience. But I want to maybe begin with the central character in the book, who is something of a cipher, and we don't hear that much about her. And it's quite interesting, because even while reading some of the reviews in German that have appeared, sometimes it's referred to as Die Hexe, but quite often they quote the original Spanish, which I'm going to mispronounce as probably La Bruja.
Bruja.
And so actually I would like to ask a question to Angelica in terms of what is maybe missing in Hexe, since this is really, we'll talk about the character and her place in the book, but even why is Hexe, what's lacking?
Maybe I also... just start with a small thank. First of all, I want to thank Fernanda for having written this powerful novel and that I was able to translate it. Then I wanted to thank Wagenbach Verlag for having believed in this novel and published it, and our editor Linus Guggenberger, who is the perfect first reader. Don't know where he is now. And who really helped me to improve my, as he says, invective, my insults in German. it was not really my strongest side, and I had to work a lot on it. So thank you. Thanks to all of them. Thanks also to our community of Spanish translators, which is very solidary, and they're really some great translators. And I think this prize is a kind of recognition for acknowledgement for all of them. So I want to thank them. And then I have a small thank you to my son, who is very patient with me, and he was while I was translating this. So the Hexe, La Bruja, that is the first the first turning point when you, like, the first sentence Tiju was talking about, and the Hexe, the La Bruja also appears at the very beginning of the book, of course, and La Bruja in Spanish is something quite casual. You would call any woman who is a little bit loud, hysterical, or just mean, you call her la bruja, que bruja eres. So witch or hexe is, of course, much stronger, and in German you immediately relate to some witch burning, and it's what we have. I couldn't invent a word, and at the same time, of course, it's this meaning of hexerei, of witchcraft, and we had to work with that, and then there comes shortly after that la bruja chica, what in German would be die kleine Hexe, because that's her daughter, and at first I translated it as die kleine Hexe, because I also found found it quite cute, actually. But then
it's not a book that indulges in cuteness, if you haven't.
Yeah, so it sounded like we could use something cute. But then, together with Linus, we decided that it was just we have this children's book, Die kleine Hexe, and it's just impossible to use throughout a whole book, Die kleine Hexe. So we use the Hexenmädchen. And so these are the kinds of questions you come to.
And it's an essential one in the novel, because as we were saying, in terms of the character herself, she's really at the very beginning of it and her murder. But she doesn't speak. She doesn't have a name. Mm-hmm. I presume this is intentional.
Yeah. Well, as I was telling you, the thing I never knew and couldn't invent was the moment of the killing, because, well, a person had never killed anybody and never been killed, so I couldn't like tell exactly what happens when. So I decided to make that moment silent and to silent the voice of the victim and the murderer. So in fact, they are the only, they speak now and then, but they don't really have a narrator behind them. So everybody in the novel, they speak of them, of the victim and the killer. And they don't really have a voice, because I wanted to leave that. You know, as in the most important characters are the ones that you have to picture through the voices of others. And with that, I wanted a little bit to honor this way that sometimes we think it's a low form of speaking, that it's gossip, you know? And it's I wanted to pretend that the book is like a big gossip told by the voices of women of the village. I wanted to create that kind of sound and that kind of you know, when you are gossiping around and someone is telling you something that you really really are interested in knowing, or when somebody is spoiling you of I don't know, of a TV series, for example, and you listen with interest. I wanted to copy that, so that's why also the novel has this structure of long sentences, of long phrases, because I wanted to feel like somebody was talking to you in your ear and telling you this whole story about these people who you might never know, but who you get to know really really well.
Well, this is a reminder. I was thinking when Teju was speaking, this notion that language can not only save a life, as was affirmed, but the important thing as a reader, and this goes far beyond just being on the jury, is that it can also make one feel alive, make one feel more alive as a reader. And I think one of the exciting parts about experiencing this novel is the sophistication of its form in the way that things are unraveled over the course of the novel, and even as they are unraveled, and what might appear to be secret or uncertain at the beginning becomes clear, at the same time other things become more obscure and opaque, and there's no satisfaction in the resolution. And that's quite exciting as a reader, especially as you move towards the completion of the book. And the sentences as well. And we'll talk about the sentences in a minute. But I wanted to mention this because you sent also some interesting illustrations about the structure and the form. And I was hoping maybe you could share some of these. And obviously, a great deal of thinking went into how you would shape the voices who do speak or the characters that would relate the happenings.
This is like a character study. I was playing with, for example, what kind of characteristics a witch will have, like psychological, or for example, and there's another character whose name is Norma. It's a really young girl of 13 years old, and her character is kind of like an orphan. So I don't know. I was just playing around, like what kind of. These are like the main points of the story. It's in Spanish, so there's no spoilers here, I guess. And like the main characters and what are the... These are like the whole chapters reduced in sentences, quick sentences, because normally I imagine what happens And then I took the time to write, like really work. And this is like the beginning always of the story, of the main. Here in pencil is a little map of the village that I created. There is, it doesn't really exist. I created for my necessities, right? And basically I just write a lot of by hand and these ideas, and then I type. And this novel actually was a really bit difficult. It is my second novel, and I silly me thought that it would be a lot easier because just I had already done a novel, so I was thinking, oh, the second one must be, it has to be easier. And in fact, it wasn't. It was like hell. And I think I needed therapy after, when I finished writing Hurricane Season, Saison der Bilderstürme. Okay, well, sorry for that. And so it took me like 2 years, but actually the writing took me 6 weeks. And then it was, for me, it's revision, always revision. And that's why the structure is so tight. And Angelica, who I totally forgot to say thank you to, because I'm such a distracted person, but I wanted to thank her of her great job, the almost impossible job. You know, when I said that Hurricane Season was being translated into German, somebody tweeted like, they should build you a statue, because really it's a very colloquial and really verbal book. It's written in a very vulgar style. And to translate that, all that Mexican flavor into an foreign language, as is German for us in Mexico, is quite a task. I don't know, taking in consideration all the reviews that that Linus has sent me, I think you did it great, and I'm so happy. It's such a strange feeling to hold a book where you can understand even a word and think it's yours, and it is also Angelica's. It is also Angelica's.
And that's actually. And the force and the fury of this novel's extraordinary sentences I experienced, of course, in German, which is part of the reason I want to ask you this next question, because you're the one who generated the German, not maybe the material from which it was made, but the sentences that we read. And what were some of the particular challenges in terms of the gap that exists between the original Mexican Spanish and where you had to ferry it in order for it to arrive in German?
Yeah, I think the difficulty was not so much as we were talking about those long sentences and the density of the text. Actually, what makes it quite easy to enter, to start with the translation, is when the text has a voice, and this text has a very strong voice and a rhythm, and so you. Somehow you can hear something. It's something that seems like an equivalence in German, though of course it's completely different, but it sounds like something that could be this if it would be German. It's difficult to explain, but you create like a level between the original language and the German, or whatever language is translated to, and then you move on this level, and you have to change things. You have to change, like in Mexican Spanish, all those the repeating words they use just to talk to, and as it's a lot of oral languages, as Fernanda said. So they, like for instance, the word pinche, I looked it up before this evening, and it appears like 250 times through the novel, and we just didn't have this word. And so I have to create something, or sometimes leave it out, sometimes create something else. It's what it's something like verdammt, or I use a lot
magnified from verdammt.
But I can't use it all the time because it would just be too much. So I have to, to level down a bit because the German sensibility for bad language is lower. And if I would translate all of the bad words, I wouldn't do good to the original because it would seem like this is a horrible text. And how could this is only they're only insulting each other, and they don't, because sometimes it's really tender what they say. Just we wouldn't understand it if I
just don't ask
literally.
Google Translate.
I think that was the most difficult. Apart from the localism, so I had a Mexican friend whom I could ask for some words even Spanish natives wouldn't understand, and then sometimes my Mexican friend who comes from Oaxaca wouldn't know a word, and then I had to ask Fernanda because this word comes from Veracruz, or as she then told me, or from her family. So
I invented so.
That's of course in every translation you have to do this kind of research and
Well, maybe it's a good moment to stop talking about language and to actually hear it in use. And Fernanda, would you mind reading an excerpt from the book in Spanish, and then we can perhaps hear the
I
way
think
that
we have to use this microphone.
This is the opening of the novel.
1. Llegaron al canal por la brecha que sube del río, con las ondas frescas para la batalla y los ojos entornados, cosidos casi 5, y su líder, el único que llevaba traje de baño, una truza colorada que ardía entre las matas sedientas del cañaveral enano de principios de mayo. El resto de la tropa lo seguía en calzoncillos, los 4 calzados en botines de fango, los 4 cargando por turnos el balde de piedras menudas que aquella misma mañana sacaron del río, los 4 ceñudos y fieros y tan dispuestos a inmolarse que ni siquiera el más pequeño de ellos se hubiera atrevido a confesar que sentía miedo. Al avanzar con sigilo a la saga de sus compañeros, la liga de la resortera tensa en sus manos, el guijarro apretado en la bandana de cuero, listo para descalabrar lo primero que le saliera al paso si la señal de la emboscada se hacía presente. En el chillido del vientebeo, reclutado como vigía en los árboles a sus espaldas.
O en el cascabeleo de las hojas al ser apartadas con violencia. O el zumbido de las piedras al partir el aire frente a sus caras. La brisa caliente, cargada de sopilotes etéreos contra el cielo casi blanco y de una peste que era peor que un puño de arena en la cara. Un hedor que daban ganas de escupir para que no bajara las tripas, que quitaba las ganas de seguir avanzando. Pero el líder señaló el borde de la cañada y los 5 agatas sobre la hierba seca, los 5 apiñados en un solo cuerpo, los 5 rodeados de moscas verdes reconocieron al fin lo que asomaba sobre la espuma amarilla del agua, el rostro podrido de un muerto entre los juncos y las bolsas de plástico que el viento empujaba desde la carretera, la máscara prieta que bullía en una miríada de culebras negras y sonreía.
Man nannte sie die Hexe, wie ihre Mutter, Hexenmädchen, als die Alte ihr Geschäft mit dem Heilen und den Zaubersprüchen anfing, und einfach nur Hexe, als sie allein zurückblieb, damals, im Jahr des Erdrutschs. Sollte sie einmal einen anderen Namen gehabt haben, vielleicht festgehalten auf einem zerknitterten, wurmstichigen Zettel, von der Alten in einen der Schränke zwischen Tüten, schmutzstarrende Lumpen, ausgerissene Haarbüschel, Knochen und Essensreste gestopft. Sollte sie einmal Vor- und Nachnamen besessen haben wie die übrigen Dorfbewohner, so hat niemand jemals davon erfahren. Nicht einmal die Frauen, die freitags ins Haus kamen, hatten je gehört, dass die Alte sie anders gerufen hätte. Immer nur, du dumme Gans, oder du Drecksgöre, oder verdammte Teufelsbrut, wenn die Alte wollte, dass das Mädchen zu ihr kommen oder den Mund halten, oder einfach nur still unter dem Tisch sitzen sollte, damit sie den Klagen der Frauen lauschen konnte, dem Stöhnen, mit dem sie ihre Sorgen, Beschwerden und schlaflosen Nächte würzten, den Träumen von verstorbenen Angehörigen und dem Streit mit denen, die noch lebten. Und fast immer ging es um Geld oder den Ehemann oder dieses Hurenpack von der Landstraße. Und ich weiß nicht, warum sie mich immer verlassen, wenn ich am glücklichsten bin. Sie heulten. Wozu das alles? Sie schluchzten. Lieber sterbe ich gleich.
Und mit dem Zipfel ihres Kopftuchs wischten sie sich das Gesicht ab, das sie verhüllten, sobald sie die Küche der Hexe verließen. Man wusste ja nie. So wie die Leute im Dorf tratschten. Sonst hieß es noch, dass man zur Hexe ging, weil man sich an jemanden rächen wollte. Dass man das Flittchen, das einem den Mann abluchsen wollte, mit einem Fluch belegte. Denn an Intrigantinnen fehlt es nie. Wo man sich doch einfach nur ein Mittel gegen die Magenverstimmung seines idiotischen Sohns holte, der ganz allein ein Kilo Kartoffeln verdrückt hatte. Oder einen Tee gegen die Müdigkeit oder eine Salbe für die Unpässlichkeiten des Unterleibs. Oder sich bloß eine Weile in der Küche etwas von der Seele reden, den Kummer loswerden wollte. Den Schmerz, der ihn hoffnungslos in der Kehle zappelte. Denn die Hexe hörte zu. Und die Hexe konnte offenbar nichts erschüttern. Ja, es hieß sogar, dass sie ihren Mann umgebracht hatte. Keinen geringeren als das Schlitzohr Manolo Conde. Ja, ja, und zwar des Geldes wegen, um an seine Kohle, sein Haus und seine Ländereien zu kommen. An die 100 Hektar Feld- und Weideland, die ihm sein Vater vererbt hatte, also das, was noch übrig davon war, nachdem er fast alles stückchenweise an den Gewerkschaftsführer der Zuckerrohrfabrik verkauft hatte, um bloß nie arbeiten zu müssen, um von seinen Kapitalerträgen und seinen sogenannten Geschäften zu leben, die immer schief gingen. Aber das Anwesen war so groß, dass, als Don Manolo starb, immer noch ein guter Teil da war und auch noch einiges abwarf. Weshalb seine Söhne, zwei erwachsene Kerle mit abgeschlossener Ausbildung, die Don Manolo mit seiner rechtmäßigen Ehefrau drüben in Montiel Sosa gezeugt hatte, im Dorf auftauchten, kaum dass sie vom Tod des Vaters erfahren hatten. Ein jäher Herzinfarkt, hatte der Arzt von Villa gesagt, als die beiden zu diesem Haus inmitten der Zuckerrohrfelder kamen, wo die Totenwache abgehalten wurde. Und eben dort erklärten sie der Hexe vor aller Augen, dass sie sich bis zum nächsten Tag fortscheren sollte. Aus dem Haus und aus dem Dorf. Das ja wohl nicht ganz richtig im Kopf war, wenn sie glaubte, als Söhne würden sie es zulassen, dass eine dahergelaufene Schlampe das Erbe ihres Vaters an sich riss. Die Ländereien und das Haus. Nach all den Jahren war es immer noch beinahe ein Rohbau. So grandios und missraten wie Don Manolos Träume. Mit seiner geschwungenen Treppe, auf deren Geländer sich Gipsengel tummelten. Und den mächtig hohen Decken, unter denen Fledermäuse nisteten. Und dem Geld, das dort irgendwo versteckt sein musste. Ein Haufen Centenario-Goldmünzen, die Don Manolo von seinem Vater geerbt und nie zur Bank gebracht hatte. Und der Diamantring, den niemand je zu Gesicht bekommen hatte. Nicht einmal die Söhne, dessen Stein aber, so erzählte man sich, so groß war, dass man ihn für eine Fälschung hielt. Eine echte Reliquie, die Don Manolos Großmutter gehört hatte, Señora Chusita Villagarbosa de los Monteros de Conde, und der allen irdischen wie göttlichen Gesetzen nach der Mutter der jungen Männer zustand. Don Manolos rechtmäßige Ehefrau vor Gott und den Menschen. Und nicht dieser zugereisten Nutte, dieser kriecherischen Schlange, dieser Mörderin, dieser Hexe, die jetzt die feine Dame spielte. Dabei hatte Don Manolo die kleine Hure aus irgendeiner Dreckshütte im Wald geholt, um in der Einsamkeit der Hochebenen jemanden zu haben, an dem er seine niedersten Instinkte befriedigen konnte. Kurzum, eine schlechte Frau, die irgendwie, vielleicht hat es ihr der Teufel selbst eingeflüstert, glaubten manche, oben auf dem Berg ein Kraut gefunden hatte zwischen den Ruinen, die, wie die von der Regierung sagten, Gräber der Vorfahren waren, die früher diese Gegenden bewohnt hatten, die zuerst hier gewesen waren, noch vor den Gatubines von Spanien. Aber die hatten das alles hier von ihren Schiffen aus gesehen und im Handumdrehen gehörte das Land der Krone von Kastilien. Und die paar Vorfahren, die noch übrig waren, mussten in den Bergen Zuflucht suchen und alles hinter sich lassen. Sogar die Steine ihrer Tempel, die beim Wirbelsturm 78 schließlich vom Berg bedeckt wurden, als der Erdrutsch über 100 Einwohner von La Matosa im Schlamm begrub und auch die Ruinen, zwischen denen dieses Kraut wuchs, aus dem die Hexe, sagte man, ein Gift braute, das man weder sah noch schmeckte und das keinerlei Spuren hinterließ. Denn sogar der Arzt von Villa erklärte, dass Don Manolo an einem Herzinfarkt gestorben sei. Doch die beiden dämlichen Söhne beharrten darauf, dass man ihn vergiftet hatte. Und die Leute gaben der Hexe später auch die Schuld am Tod von Don Manolos Söhnen, weil die noch am Tag der Beerdigung auf der Landstraße umkamen, als sie mit ihrem Auto den Leichenzug zum Friedhof von Villa anführten und sich von einem vor ihnen fahrenden Lastwagen an der Ladung Eisenstangen löste und beide erschlug. Auf den Fotos in der Zeitung war nur blutverschmiertes Eisen zu sehen, eine schreckliche Sache. Keiner vermochte sich je zu erklären, wie dieser Unfall passieren konnte, wie die Stangen sich lösen, die Windschutzscheibe zerschmettern und die Insassen durchbohren konnten. Und mehr als einer nahm es zum Anlass, um die Hexe zu beschuldigen. Die Hexe hat ihnen einen Fluch angehängt, um Haus und Ländereien zu behalten. Das verdorbene Weib hat sich dem Teufel im Tausch gegen dunkle Mächte hingegeben. Und etwa zu dieser Zeit sperrte sich die Hexe in ihrem Haus ein und kam nicht mehr heraus. Weder tagsüber noch nachts. Vielleicht aus Angst vor der Rache der Condes oder vielleicht, weil sie etwas zu verbergen hatte. Ein Geheimnis, das sie hüten musste. Irgendetwas in jenem Haus, das ihres Schutzes bedürfte. sie wurde mager und blass. Ihr Blick allein war angsteinflößend und verwirrt. Und es waren die Frauen von La Matosa, die ihr Essen brachten und dafür ihre Hilfe in Anspruch nahmen. Sich von ihr Mittelchen mischen, Tränke aus den Kräutern brauen ließen, die die Hexe selbst in ihrem Hinterhofgärtchen anpflanzte oder die auf dem Berg zu pflücken sie den Frauen auftrug. Damals, als es den Berg noch gab.
I'd like to ask a question about collaboration, and in part the collaboration between the two of you, but even more broadly, because as with Teju in his first novel, you've had this great good fortune for this novel to be translated into several languages, some of which these translations, for example, into English are in progress or just wrapping up. And I was quite amused by some of the things one could find on Twitter. In both directions. On the one hand, for example, the English language translator marveling at, and I'm going to quote you a tweet here, "The riches of Mexico's Spanish potty mouth knows no comparison, and sometimes as a translator, I despair. But sometimes I remember that in English, unthinkingly, we do things like turn scared witless into scared shitless just because we can, and I think it's going to be okay." And it's not just in this one direction of this translator into English communicating her process among other translators who follow her and respond to it, but it's also you have posed certain questions about idioms by way of social media and Twitter to the translators of different languages, correct?
Yeah, I always marvel at the things that in one language we take for granted and turns out to be really strange for other people who's trying to communicate that idea. And for example, I think it was how do you say Holandese? Is the Dutch language. They asked me what does, it's something, and you did ask it too, about the phrase who's called, Kim Pompo, for example, and it's just a line from a song, a really tropical song, a cumbia song, and it's about it's a man who's asking the girl who buy her those shoes, and it's a stupid song about and people uses that phrase to ask it if they see you with new shoes, it's like Kim Pompo, o sea, who give it to you, even if you buy it yourself. It doesn't make sense. It is just like that. But it's, you know, in Mexican Spanish, I think the relationship with Spanish is a little bit complicated because the language was imposed into original Mexican habitants. So we, as Mexicans, have found a way of always turning the language and making its bite its own tail. And we are always playing and trying to say things in another form of that same language. It's just, for example, if I say for me, para mí, I will say also para Miguelito. Miguelito is a name, but Miguelito, it's also me. And I don't know, we're always doing these silly jokes with the language, and it can be also really strong and vulgar with sexual content also. But it's really difficult that to even to explain sometimes from the translator. So I will show Angelica some YouTube videos with the songs, and she will give the flavor of that, but into words that could be understandable. And with English, it's also the same way. I think I love Spanish. I think but that always happened with one's mother tongue. What one native tongue is the best because it's yours, and at the same time is the worst for expressing what you must say because it's your tongue, it's your language. So you can, I think what we do in Mexico to turn always the meaning of and searching new senses for old words, I think it's a form of resistance. It's like, okay, I have this language, but I'm going to do whatever I want with it, and I'm going to be creative to express the things I must. And I was, I even had not a discussion, but I saw in social media, a person from Spain told me that my book promised a lot, but he didn't finish it because he thought it was written in Spanish. Because he said that what I spoke wasn't Spanish, was Mexican or something like that. So I think, Spanish is beautiful because it requires more effort to not understand between Argentinians, Costa Ricans, Mexicans, Mexican Americans, for example, Spaniards. Then it is more complicated not to be understood than to be understood, and I think it's beautiful. And also, when I was in Vienna, I have a reader also in German, and a gentleman from the audience just stand up and said that he was a little bit offended because it was Northern German language. It was translated into, and I said I'm totally agree with you because as a Mexican, I have to read a lot of literature written in Spanish from Spain.
I'm just imagining the German publishers who are here today, if they're willing to follow this model that you often find, for example, in Brazil and Portugal, yeah. They're two different translations. And so I wonder if we need to now have like a Schweiz or Übersetzung.
And I said to the gentleman, of course, I totally understand you. I wish there was also a BN1's translation of Hurricane Season. Why not? Anyway, so I think it's translation is beautiful because it connects. I read a lot of books, translated books in my infancy when I was a child, and I think it's great to have the possibility of enter in one author's mind, and not to worry about did he really meant that or he was using, no, and that's the job of the translator, and I think it's beautiful because it just makes the things work for us, and that's the way it must be.
I wonder about you. Did you, by any chance, communicate with translators into the other languages? You lived in Paris for 10 years. That doesn't necessarily mean that you would be in touch with the translator into French. Have you communicated with other people working on the novel at all, or has it been largely?
No. Usually, unfortunately, if there's not some kind of official reunion or some get-together, we're not really in contact with the translators into the other languages. I was in contact with Fernanda, and that was a nice collaboration because it was very funny and open. But otherwise, no.
Well, a little bit earlier, I said something that, like, along the lines of you've had the great good fortune to be translated into many other languages. And since we're wrapping up now, I'd actually like to turn that phrase around and say that we have the great good fortune to receive this novel in German, in the edition published by Wagenbach. And so I would like to make sure that everybody who is here tonight sees that over there, that there is a stand with books, lots of books, all of the books from the shortlist. And I think we're fortunate to have Saison der Wirbelstürmer, and perhaps you can buy your copy, and perhaps you can even get it signed by the two winners of the prize. And I assume this is a rare opportunity in Berlin, that one from Barcelona, one from Mexico City. But also as well, there are the other titles on the shortlist, which I think open up new ways and exhilarating ways for all of the darkness in the matter that they communicate, or often communicate, not all of them, but there really is joy and in delight, I think, in what they bring, what they do to German, what these books through the translators have done to expand the range of what is possible, not just for other writers in German, but I think for readers of German as well. And I'm very grateful to the publishers, Wagenbach, the publishers of the other shortlist. I know I speak for the rest of the jury ourselves, and perhaps maybe this is a moment to acknowledge the 100 plus books that we read that were also outstanding in a year of just extraordinary reading, I think, for all of us. This is part of the reason it was so difficult to suddenly have to reduce things to six. But yes, all of that is a way of perhaps moving towards the final phase of the party, or the first phase of the party, and maybe a round of applause for Fernanda and Angelica in appreciation for their wonderful book.
Thank you, Daniel, for your presentation. And all the, I forgot to thank the jury when I was thanking. So thank you for all the reading you did and the faith you had in this marvelous novel. Thank you.